Hello and welcome to Season 4 of Somerset Stories, the podcast which explores the lives of the people who live, work and create in Somerset. My name is Lewis Webb, and each week I get to share the stories of some of the inspiring, creative and successful individuals and families that make this beautiful county their home. We're back for a new season with 14 fantastic guests lined up ready to share their lives and insights. Plus, we've got a brand new game to play to test their Somerset knowledge to the limits. As ever, your comments, reviews and feedback are always appreciated. And if you'd like to send us a message, you can email hello@somersetstories.com. As we approach the traditional carnival season, my guest this week has been part of one of the county's well-known clubs from a very young age. Gemma Warren has spent over 10 years as one of the minority of Somerset's female lorry drivers. While we're in the middle of an HGV driver supply crisis in the UK, we chatted last month about her journey towards being a driver, some of the prejudices she faces, and just how difficult it is to drive a carnival cart. Gemma, welcome to Somerset Stories.
Hello.
Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me. I know you're off on holiday tomorrow, so probably I'm in the middle of your packing schedule, or are you already done?
We're half done. It's such a boring job though. I'm quite glad of the break.
While you're away on your holiday, will you be listening to podcasts? Do you follow any regularly?
There's a few that I follow. There's one that's quite different to yours called In the Doghouse, that it's more like pirate radio, but it is quite funny for truckers and tractor drivers and people that are into that sort of like motor vehicle sort of thing. And there's a truck and driver podcast as well that I listen to. And I have started listening to yours as well quite regularly.
Oh, thank you. I hope it entertains you on the road. Regular listeners will know that some of our guests on the podcast grew up outside of the county, but you're Somerset born and bred, aren't you?
I am, yes. I grew up in Bridgewater, and the only other place I have lived is Bristol, and that was only for a few years. I grew up on the south side of Bridgewater, and I went to the Somerset Bridge School, which was an absolutely lovely school. Couldn't fault it at all. If anybody went there, they will know what a lovely, wholesome school it was. And for the most part of that, it was because of the head teacher, Mr. Smithen. It felt like you were in a small family. And then after that, I went up to the Blake School, which was a little bit more challenging. You go from such a nice community school to something that is quite overwhelming and scary in some ways. But I don't think it did me sort of a disservice in some ways. Although I didn't get the best education, I did learn how to stand up for myself, how to look after myself. And it was almost like going through a horrible thing as a girl, and girls are horrible anyway at that age, but to get through it and come out the other side, I've got a lot more confidence. So I don't think it was a bad thing.
Did you see your school then as useful from a life skills and kind of getting by learning, but maybe not so much on the academic side
yes,
of things?
Definitely. I mean, I think there were certain subjects that, and I had a certain number of teachers that did care, but my English did suffer, and I've learnt more since I've left school on the English side of my skills than I did at school, because I felt like instead of being taught to get things right, it was just pushed to one side, or, well, that's wrong. It wasn't explained why it was wrong.
Did you enjoy any of the more creative outlets at school then?
Yeah, that was my favourite. My favourite subjects were the art subjects, the expressive arts, the visual arts, the textiles, and that's where I got my best grades. And I was also more inclined to do maths and science as well. I found that quite easy compared to, say, English and written subjects. And actually, what let me down in my art subjects was my English. So when you have to explain what you did in your workings, I wasn't very good at explaining those sort of things. So instead of getting the A star in expressive arts, it was an A. which, you know, if I had those skills that were a little bit better, then maybe I could have upped those grades.
Well, you know, A is still good, so well done.
Well, yeah, I was quite impressed with that. I did really enjoy that.
Outside of school, what was life like at home?
I grew up in a household where my mum and dad had come from families that weren't wealthy, but I don't know if you know much about council estates, but to me there are two types of people that grow up on a council estate. There are the ones that don't care, and then there are the really proud, hard-working families that work in the same job all their life, save up and buy the things that they want and really look after them, and they look after their house and their garden. And that was the sort of family that I came from. My parents managed to save up enough to buy their own house. But they were short of money, but it never felt like a big deal. Not really until I went up to senior school, I think. You know, you just got on with it, and I still got to go to dancing and gymnastics, but I did have hand-me-down clothes, and, you know, we couldn't do everything that we wanted to. I didn't go to sort of adventure parks or anything like that, and we didn't go on holidays abroad. So I was quite grateful, actually, that I had the dancing and gymnastics rather than the holidays abroad. I think that in my life and what's happened in my life, it's really done me a favour.
While you were doing dancing, gymnastics and that kind of activity, was that something that you saw yourself doing as a career, you know, professionally?
Yeah, I guess so. As a child, I always wanted to be an Olympic gymnast. That was that was what I wanted to be. Not that I would have ever have made it that far due to, you know, the time that I could spend in the gym. And it was quite an expensive hobby as well, and it wasn't something that my parents could afford to send me to do. Not without really going without themselves, and possibly my sister as well. But the chances are, I mean, it's so hard. It really is a hard sport to keep up that I probably wouldn't have made it anyway. So I think it was probably a good thing that I didn't go any further with it at that time.
Outside of that, I know that you probably grew up closer to kind of large vehicles and machinery than maybe a lot of people do. Can you tell me a bit more about your first interactions, I suppose, with lorries and excavators and that kind of thing?
Yeah, it was around all of the time, I guess. My dad was a HGV mechanic, and my gramps used to do demolition and excavation and stuff like that with a Caterpillar. And that was around the Sunday dinner table. That was all they would talk about. And I think my probably earliest memories. So I went to this preschool nursery, and it was right by the entrance to where my dad and gramps worked. And I was out playing, and I can remember seeing through the fence my dad coming through with, I think it was like an eight-wheeler or something like that. And I just felt so excited to see it. It just really filled me with joy. And obviously, being from Bridgewater as well, the carnival, they were really, really huge vehicles being pulled through the streets. And my family was quite heavily involved with Vagabonds Carnival Club. So growing up, I was always around that sort of thing.
You're very much continuing the family tradition then, I suppose. You posted a story on Instagram earlier this year about how your grandfather learned to drive lorries. What can you tell me about that?
Yeah, his dad was a truck driver. I didn't know him because he died at quite a young age. But it was back in the days when there weren't so many restrictions on truck drivers, and I wouldn't say it wasn't so difficult to get your license, because it was, but there weren't so many rules and the roads were quieter. And so my great granddad would go to the pub after work, like most people did. It was quite common for that to happen. And he'd have one too many, and then my gramps would have to drive the truck back to the house because he hadn't had a drink.
And how old would he have been?
Oh, he would have been a teenager. So, but it was just one of those things that nobody would have batted an eyelid to. And to be fair, it's probably safer than my great-granddad getting in and driving at home himself. So things have changed quite a lot. And I think with how busy the roads are, it's probably for the better.
You've not always been a lorry driver. You spent some time in the circus. How did you get into that?
So there was a friend of mine that's in Vagabonds Carnival Club, and she went off and joined the circus. And I didn't really know what she was doing there. I just presumed it was like juggling and clowning and a bit of aerial, a bit of this, a bit of that. And then she came back to perform at a carnival concert, doing some of her aerial. And I just can remember looking up and going, I want to do that. And I was 19. And I spoke to her about it, and she said, nope, you can go to circus school and you can just do aerial. I went up to her circus school within a couple of days, and within a week I'd enrolled. So it was quite quick, but for some reason, I just looked at her and I knew 100% that's what I wanted to do.
What were some of your signature acts then?
I'm not sure if I had any particularly signature acts. I used to enjoy the silks probably the most. And then I had a hoop and a trapeze. And I used to do a bit of rope as well. But I think the silks were my favourite. Not that I got very far into my career before getting glandular fever. And it really knocked me for six. So I ended up being diagnosed with chronic fatigue. And I suppose it's a bit like people who get COVID and then they have long COVID. I just couldn't get out of that tiredness feeling. And it got to the point where I had to decide whether I wanted to keep trying with the circus, even though I was making no progress, which was such a shame because before I got glandular fever, I was at my strongest. I really was at the top of my game. And looking back, I didn't think I was that good at the time. And I see performances now that are out and about and in like really good circuses. And I think I could have done that and I could have done it better. I was more confident, but at the time I just didn't have the confidence in myself. So it was a real shame. Sometimes I think, oh, I'd love to be in the position where I could just do it as a hobby. But yeah, I had to make the decision whether to give it up or to try and carry on. And I decided it was probably best to forget about it for a while because I needed to recover. I needed to do something that wasn't strenuous on my body. I was training 8 hours a day, or I should have been training 8 hours a day, which I didn't have it in me to train 8 hours a day. So I decided to move back to Bridgewater. And it felt really tough, but I got a job in an agency and I did different bits of work and ended up picking and packing in a factory. And I just saved and saved and saved. And that is then when I applied for my lorry licence. And I'd done the theory and I'd done the test. And luckily, I passed first time. Because if I didn't, I wouldn't have had enough money to have taken another test.
One of the things that you already mentioned as being important in your desire to drive lorries and to sort of be involved in that is the carnival. And for the whole county, that's a really significant event. But I would imagine that you would argue that Bridgewater's is the best.
Well, of course it is. I think, to be fair, every club goes to every carnival. So it's the same carnival that you'll see at every place. But I think because it's the first one, it's the one where everyone debuts their carts. I think that's why it's so special.
What was it in particular, aside from just, you know, the family being involved in Vagabonds, that got you interested?
I can't remember a time where I was like, just looked at it and thought, that's what I want to do. It just, being in a carnival family, it's just something that you do. And it wasn't, to be honest, it wasn't until I moved away from Bridgewater, I realised that that's not what everybody does. It just seems so normal to me that you just, it's a way of life.
While you were growing up then, how did being part of that culture and community make you feel?
It's a brilliant feeling. Everyone in the club, they are like a family. It's almost like I've got a lot of aunties and uncles and like cousins, and growing up with people in carnival, you kind of look out for each other. And although I've got not a lot of family, biologically, there are people within the club that I've grown up with, that I've known from birth. And I know if I had a problem, I could go to them. And it was great for learning a work ethic as well, because you're fundraising all year, then you need to build the cart and bring it out on a deadline, and you're doing all this for free, and it didn't feel like work, but you were tired from doing it. So it was really good, you know. It made work fun.
You've piloted carts in the past as well, haven't you? What's that experience like?
Absolutely brilliant. I always said from a teenager, I think it was actually in 1999, we brought out a cart called Viva Brazil. And I was 14 and I looked at it and I went, I'm going to drive a carnival cart one day. And everyone sort of went, oh, yeah, all right. And eventually I did get to the point where I could drive the cart. And that was why I wanted to get my lorry license, was to drive a carnival car. It wasn't to do it as a job. It's just ended up that that's what I've done. But yeah, driving the carnival car, it was... I didn't probably think it through at 14. I didn't think about how big it was and how hard it would be and how cold it would be. Sort of out in the elements in November, being quite still... you haven't got much visibility down the sides of the carts. You're relying on your road crew to basically be your eyes. So it's quite scary in that respect. It's narrow streets and there's a lot of people. And it is really scary. You're so worried about not only running somebody over, but the personnel on cart as well. Because you have to drive so smoothly. They're up there dancing and giving it their all. And you've almost got to think of it as smoother than, say, a bus, where people stand up on a bus. Because they're trying to move and dance at the same time as you're trying to start and stop.
With all that going on then, do you even get a chance to sort of emotionally take in that you're fulfilling this childhood dream?
No. To be honest, the Bridgewater Carnival was the one that I wanted to drive. And it wasn't for quite a few years that I drove other carnivals before Bridgewater. The first time I drove Bridgewater, I was so nervous that it actually ruined my experience. It wasn't as fun as I thought it was going to be. But maybe if I did it again, I've only driven Bridgewater the once. It should have been my turn last year, I think. But obviously, it was postponed. But I don't know what will happen next year. maybe I will be able to drive Bridgewater again, and hopefully I'll enjoy it a bit more.
You mentioned obviously the last couple of years, this year and last year, not having carnivals in Somerset. How do you think that's impacted the local community?
I think it's been hard not to see people and have the social interaction. But for the people who are very much involved and it does take over their life, it's been a necessary break. I love carnival to bits, but I have enjoyed having that. Well, I would have liked it just a year off, I think. But I'm quite happy to have the break just for a minute. But I am itching to get back behind the wheel again.
So what will be happening this year? Is there a smaller sort of get-together?
Yeah, so it's more or less a local show and a local parade for local people. It's mainly for carnivalites, I would say, and people who really enjoy carnival and are local. It's not going to be anything spectacular. It's just going to be a social occasion where we can just all get together and have a bit of fun.
And what are your hopes and expectations for next year's events? Is it going to be back with bigger and better than ever?
Oh, yeah, I hope so. I hope it really is back with a bang. I mean, some clubs have... The clubs are very, very good at building. I think most of them have started. They've been itching to get going. So hopefully all those clubs that would have normally gone, well, don't really have the time to put that spinning part on, so we'll leave that as a standing part, but we'll make everything else spin. So that part that they couldn't quite have time to do might be spinning or moving. So I think it will be a lot better. I think we've got some surprises.
Something I think that has been documented in some of your previous interviews is just how much hard work it was for you to break into a career as a driver. Did you have a feeling of that difficulty before you started out on this journey?
No, I think I was quite naive, actually. I thought I was never brought up in a household where because you're a girl, you can't do something. Like my mum and dad always said to me, you can do anything you want as long as you're a nice person. So it wasn't something that I thought, oh, you can't do that because you're a girl. But actually getting my licence was the easy part. It was then trying to find a job. But it's not just hard for women. I think that went against me a little bit with smaller companies. They just didn't want to take the risk on me. But also a lot of companies, they want you to have 2 years experience. Well, if you aren't given the opportunity to get experience, you can't have 2 years experience. And then I got a call from Wiseman's, which is a local milk company, and they said, oh, do you want to come in for an interview? So I said, yeah, of course I do. And I went in for the interview and they said, yeah, we can give you a job. And within a week of starting, they announced redundancies. And I thought, oh my God, you know, what could possibly have happened with my luck? I felt so unlucky. So I ended up working for 6 months while they arranged who was going to be made redundant. Then I went into the factory to work for a couple of weeks. And then I thought, oh, they've got a tanker side that is separate from their distribution. So I thought, oh, I'll walk over and just see if they've got any jobs over there. And they did. So they ended up taking me on over there, and the first day out as a milk tanker driver, I knew that was what I wanted to do. Farm work was definitely the one for me. Collecting from farms, and I stayed there for 8 years. I really, really did enjoy picking up milk from farms.
It's that, you know, almost a really great connection with the rest of the county and the rest of like what makes the area quite special as well. And I think in farms you're collecting from the people and their livelihood. It's not just a sort of faceless goods
Yeah, and we only collected in sort of a local area, sort of Somerset, Devon and Dorset. We didn't go really out of those three counties. And when I first started collecting milk, it was mainly small family farms. And you'd say pick up 8 or 10 on each trip. But coming to the end of working there, a lot of the smaller family farms were really struggling, and it was either they gave up milking or they got bigger. And there was almost like a shift, which was a real shame, because when I first started, you'd always see the farmer or the family members and you'd have a chat. But slowly over time, it became less personal. There are still, you know, the family farms, but there are a lot of, I guess, like factory farming, really.
Earlier on, you mentioned that there was a sort of 6-month period between wanting to start and actually being able to land that first job. Obviously, a lot of negative voices around you, people not wanting to take risks, people sort of saying that it's not right for you. Where did you go for that reassurance that this was the right thing for you?
I don't know, really. Like, no one could tell me otherwise, I think. I think I was so, like, tunnel visioned on the fact that that's what I wanted to do, and I wanted to get experience to drive the carnival car. That was my main objective, was to get the experience. But then when I started on the milk tanker job, I thought, actually, I really like this. But yeah, I can't remember anyone's bad comments making me think, no, I can't do it.
So there was never a point where you considered giving up?
No, not at all.
So over 10 years on, then, since you first started, are you surprised that, I know you said earlier that the sort of prejudice against you as a woman was maybe a small part, but are you surprised that those prejudices still exist in the industry?
Yeah, massively. I mean, I think it has got better over time, and there are a lot more women in the industry now. I now work for a smaller company called Wayne's, and there's two girls that work there, me and another girl. And we are seeing a lot more girls entering the industry. So I'm hoping that it is going to sort of not be taken any notice of.
Yeah, I saw actually recently, even sort of getting as far as the BBC News site, there was an article on female truck drivers, and I think it was around 1%, 1-2% of the industry were female. So I guess if that is on, it is growing, that can only be a good thing.
Yeah, I think so. And I don't think it's a difficult job. I don't think it's necessarily just a man's job. I don't think there's any qualities that a man has that a woman doesn't have to be able to do the job. And the thing is, it's the people who don't like women in the industry are a very, very small minority. And I guess you notice them more because they will make a beeline for you to say something silly, you know, to make you feel bad. But actually the majority of people in the industry are really pleased to see you. And although there is kind of, when you start a new job, you can't drive until you prove that you can. And once you prove that, you're treated like everybody else. I don't think there is a massive problem. I mean, where I work now at Wayne's, people come to me and ask me for advice, you know, or say my boss or the boss's son will point new people in my direction to give them advice. So I don't think it's a massive problem. It's just that there are a minority that will make it seem like a problem.
One problem that does exist in the HGV and driving industry at the moment is the shortage of drivers. That is something which is in the news a lot these days. as someone on the inside, what's your perspective as to how we got into this problem?
I think there are an awful lot of reasons, and none of the reason, although we'd all like a bit more money, it's not to do with the pay. Not at all. There are, I think it's around 80,000 people in the country who have got HGV licences that actually don't use them, because it's mainly because of things like the facilities, trying to find somewhere to park. Legally, you're required to have breaks and overnight rests of a certain period of time, and it's really hard to find parking places. The services aren't really, they're not favourable towards lorry drivers, really. Their custom, I think they get more money from the car driver. So they don't, if they had the choice, I don't think they'd have lorries in their services. We don't park in services overnight. We don't carry loads that sort of cost a lot of money. And it wouldn't be any use to anybody anyway if they did try and steal the load. So if we wanted to, say, park in the services, that's somewhere between £25 and £40 per night that's coming out of our own pocket. When you're on a low wage anyway, that's a lot of money. And you're paying for your own house at home and your own rent or your mortgage or whatever. It is vastly overpriced. And across Europe, you don't have to pay. Although, I must say that the driver shortage isn't just in the UK. There are other places in Europe that have got a bit of a crisis at the moment. Sort of food, trying to get food. If you get into the services late, or you don't go past somewhere that where you can pick up some food, and you don't have, like, I'm really lucky, I've got a microwave and a kettle in my truck and a fridge, so I can sustain myself all week, whereas there are a lot of drivers that don't have that. So if they can't find somewhere to have hot food, and if they're in a situation where they get parked up in the services, go into the services, and sometimes when you pay, you get offered a meal voucher. Well, a lot of the time, those places where you can get a meal, they're already shut. Those sort of things are hard work. The facilities like the showers, it's really hard to find toilets, especially for women more so. But even for men, it's hard. And you'll get occasions where maybe the showers, someone's gone in and sabotaged the shower. You'll go and complain, and the attitude is, well, another lorry driver done it, so it's your own fault. But you wouldn't go into a restaurant and pay £30 for a meal and go into the toilet facilities and then be unusable. So you complain, and they go, well, it was another customer that done it, so it's your own fault. You know, it would be, oh, I'm very sorry. I think there's a lot of bad attitudes towards truck drivers, and even sites that you go on, or generally sort of driving around, and so much so since COVID, people overtaking you on double white lines and cutting you up and undertaking you on roundabouts. It has become really hard work. It's not very good for mental health. It makes you feel like you're insignificant. And I have experienced that sort of behaviour and witnessed it towards other people.
I suppose that attitude, as you mentioned, is it's not seeing the driver as a person. It's seeing them as, well, you're just here to deliver or to take something from place Y to place X.
Yes.
So that's it. It just feels like that's a very, as you say, quite a short-sighted and not a healthy approach to take, particularly when we are in this predicament where people don't want to drive, as you say, because of these issues.
Yes, totally. And I think, you know, everybody's out there doing a job. So why not be nice? You know, it doesn't take any effort to be nice to somebody or to talk to somebody like a human being. I do a lot of farm work, which, okay, so I know people don't like big lorries going into their villages. But we get heads shaken at us, fists raised, shouting at us, saying you shouldn't be coming down here in a lorry. But I take food out of farms, mainly grain, and then I take it to a factory to be produced into food. And farms are in the countryside, and there's no way around that. So lorries have to go there to bring it out. If people didn't want lorries to go through their village to get to a farm and say use vans instead, so for every one lorry that goes to a farm, you would need 29 vans to take out that same produce. So you're not really coming to any sort of solution. And especially over harvest, say you might have 5 trucks go into one farm, taking 29 tons out. So if you put that into van sense, that would be, I think it's like 145 vans. So it's a lot. So what would people prefer? Would it be the 145 vans or the 5 trucks? And I know they're big, and I know, like, we'd rather not sort of squeeze through a village, but it is something that has to be done for the way that we live our lives now. I think it's just the understanding of what, none of the truck drivers I know go out there to wind people up. They're just doing a job, and it's a job that is, like, as we've seen with the shortage and, you know, there's empty supermarket shelves, it is a job that is needed. In the way that we live our lives now, where we have bulk produce, we need trucks.
So given all of that, what do you think needs to be done to improve that whole situation?
There is, obviously, to get better facilities and more parking spaces for drivers, I think it would be a good thing. But also, to combat the driver shortage, I always think about, as I'm driving along, and a lot of things go through your head, the World War II Dig for Victory. The whole attitude of growing your own vegetables in your garden. Each household grew 100 kilos of fruit and veg on average per year. To fill up a truck, if each household grew 100 kilos of fruit or veg, that would be 290 households. So say I take a load of vegetables out of a farm, that would be 29 tons, and those vegetables would go to a factory and they would be made into something, or they would be packaged. Then they'd go on another truck to a distribution centre, and then they'd go on another truck to go to the shop or the supermarket. So that's 3 trucks for 29 tonnes of vegetables. So if 290 households could grow 100 kilos of vegetables, that would mean 3 lorries are off the road, or 3 trips. Should I say 3 trips of a lorry? So, on the bigger picture, there are around 8 million households in England, or in the UK, should I say. There are obviously going to be some of those households where it's impossible to grow vegetables, whether they live in a flat or they've got no garden. So if you take, say, 5 million households, on average, growing 100 kilos of fruit and veg, some are going to grow more, some are going to grow less. That is 51,724 lorry trips a year missing. So not only are you cutting down the number of lorries on the road for an environmental purpose, you don't have to find drivers for those trucks either. And I think one of the big things I've noticed at the moment is anyone with a licence can get a job and walk straight into a job at the moment. And probably people that wouldn't normally, if there was an abundance of lorry drivers, they wouldn't be getting those jobs. And I don't know if you've seen in the news recently, there was a guy worked for quite a famous company, and he reversed his truck into his own house because he'd had a fallout with his missus. And there was another guy that had a dispute with his boss, and he just didn't put the legs down on his trailer, just drove out from underneath, causing a lot of damage. Those sort of people would not have a job in the industry. You'd have good drivers by cutting down the amount of lorries on the road. So that's one thing I think could help. I don't know if it's a bit crazy.
you spend a huge proportion of your time in your cab, obviously. Yeah. And so one thing I know that's important to you is personalization.
Yeah.
You've already said that you've got your microwave and other sort of home comforts that give you your workplace a bit of your own identity. What's your inspiration for how you decorate and modify your truck?
I think it's mainly, I am very lucky to work for a company that allows me to modify things. As long as you can take it off afterwards or take it out and it doesn't mark, anything like that, they're more than happy for you to do whatever you like. And I think that's good for a number of reasons. One being your mental health, because that is the place you're living from Monday morning till Friday night or Saturday afternoon. That is your home. So to have things around you that isn't just sort of a grey box, I think it's really important. And also, even like the outside of the cab, to have something that you're driving down the road and feeling really proud to be driving, it's a really nice feeling. So one, it's good for your mental health, and I think it's good for the company as well, because you treat the lorry like it's your own truck, like you've bought that truck. So the company benefits as well, whereas there are a lot of companies that don't like you to do anything at all. And then, I don't know, I think they suffer mentally for not having a nice surrounding that would make them feel comfortable. And I think sometimes that is what pushes people out of the industry. If you're sat there every night in a grey box, it can't be any good for you.
Speaking of that, I suppose, that time and that solitude, I suppose, of, you know, you are by yourself most of that time. How then do you keep your mental health, your mindfulness? What do you sort of spend your time thinking about when you're not making conversation with anyone else?
I've always been quite good at being on my own. I can deal with my own company, and I'm quite good at finding things to do, whether it's, oh, I'll clean this tonight, or I quite enjoy cleaning my truck and keeping it looking shiny. And probably one of the best compliments I've ever had is with my old truck. It was 6.5 years old, and someone turned around and said to their wife walking past, "You would not believe that's a working truck," because it was so clean and tidy. So to sort of get compliments like that and work towards that sort of look, that keeps me going. And also, you know, nowadays with mobile phones and you can FaceTime and stuff like that, if you did feel really down, that is an option. I spend most of my evenings, probably at least a good hour, on the phone to my boyfriend. And sometimes we won't even talk. We just have the phones next to us while we're doing things, and it feels like we're in the same room. But I know some people do struggle with the whole being alone sort of thing. And that's one thing that, if you are wanting to get into trucking, being good at being on your own is very important.
You're lucky enough to work in, you know, one of the most beautiful parts of the country.
Yeah.
What are some of your favourite routes for the scenery, or just, you know, an enjoyable drive?
To be fair, like, now that I work for Wayne's Transport, I go all over the country, and I have seen some absolutely beautiful sights. And when people say that they'd rather go abroad, I think you're mad. There's so many beautiful places in this country. And I think Somerset, Devon, Dorset, Cornwall, they've probably got some of the best places. I think the West Country has definitely got some of the nicest scenery. Well, up north, I think, if you find a spot where there's a canal, that's quite a nice setting. But doing the farm work as well, you're out in the countryside, you see the sunrise, you see the sunset. Sometimes you could be down near the sea, and that's beautiful. One of the things I absolutely love about trucking is you watch the seasons change throughout the year, and it's so beautiful. Probably one of my favourite times to drive when I was on the milk was a Sunday morning before everybody had got up, because you'd see so much wildlife. And I can remember once this white owl just perched on a post and stared at me. And it was a surreal feeling. It really was.
Finally then, what words of advice would you have for young women who might be considering this as a career, but maybe concerned about some of the difficulties that you described?
Just go for it. If that's what you want to do, just do it. I don't think, you know, if you're having second thoughts about doing it, then maybe it's not the job for you. And I think there are certain qualities that you need to have as a truck driver. And one is being able to be on your own. You need to be a problem solver, because if you come across a problem whilst you're out on the road, you're going to have to sort it out yourself. If you're the sort of person that wants to skive in a job or wants that bit of downtime, or, you know, it's definitely not the job for you, because you're up against your hours, you need to get jobs done, you need to be good at planning. You're constantly, constantly thinking when you're going down the road, or what if I get to my destination and I have to wait, or what if I get to my destination and tip straight away? Will I be able to get to my next destination? Will I be able to get on early, or be able to tip earlier or later, or, you know, and all these scenarios are going around in your head. So it's really important to be a quick thinker. And also to be able to change your plans at a drop of a hat. Because nothing will ever go to plan. No matter what happens, it will never go to plan.
But even with all that, you wouldn't change it for the world?
No, well, I find that quite exciting, to be honest. Like, I will do a job, a load, from one place to another, and I won't know what I'm doing next until I'm tipping that load. So it's like a magical mystery tour. I'll get my first load on a Monday, and then I won't know what I'm doing Monday afternoon, and then from there I won't know what I'm doing in the morning, or, you know, and it's just go, go, go. And that's what I really love.
Jen, we're now going to play Somerset Who's Who, which is the game where I give you the names of people with a Somerset connection, and then I'll give you two descriptions of who they are, and you have to tell me which of those descriptions you think is real. How are you feeling about this?
I'm quite nervous, because I've heard this.
Okay.
And I didn't get any of them.
Okay. All right. Well, let's see how you get on. All right. Your first name is Marley Packer. So, was Marley Packer a rugby player with over 70 caps for England? Or was she a pioneering Art Deco interior designer?
See, the rugby one sounds just too obvious. So I'm going to go for the Art Deco.
Well, maybe it was too obvious because it's true.
Oh!
Marley Packer is a rugby player who has played for England
right.
A number of times. All right, let's try another one. Teddy Petter. So is or was Teddy Petter a military aircraft designer or a nature documentary film director?
He sounds like a nature documentary maker.
He's the aircraft designer, I'm afraid. Two not right.
Right.
But there's still three
so
more.
So I could redeem myself a little bit.
You could. All right, your next person is Eileen Albridge. So was Eileen Albridge a chemist known for her role in sports anti-doping, or B, a Mills and Boone author who wrote under the pseudonym Jane Arbour?
Oh, now that's hard. She sounds more like a chemist.
How well do you know your Mills and Boone
novels? Not very well. I'm going to go with a chemist.
Oh, she's the author.
See, it's a hard game.
It is a hard game. Your next name is Henry McCallum. So, was Henry McCallum a former owner of Dunster Castle, or did Henry McCallum play a key role in introducing electricity to Singapore?
Well, I think he sounds more like an electrician.
You're right.
Oh,
yeah,
thank
Henry
God
McCallum.
For that. I got one right.
Henry McCallum was a pioneer of electricity in Singapore, but was originally from Somerset. All right, so your last one is Giles Daubney. Was Giles Daubney a soldier and member of parliament at the time of Henry VII, or was he a folk guitarist and singer in the 1960s?
I'm going to say folk guitarist and singer.
He was the soldier, I'm afraid.
Oh!
yeah, a little bit older. So back in the time of Henry VII, Giles Daubney. So you got one.
Yeah, I'm happy with
it,
one.
But it is a hard game.
It is a really hard game, but very interesting.
Before we go, where can people follow what you're doing, where you're driving, how you're decorating your trucks, all that kind of goodness?
You can find me on Instagram at Jem Warren, JEMWARREN. And I have just got a new truck, so I will be doing a lot of styling to that truck over the next couple of months. And I also have a TikTok account, which is JemWarren85, which is mainly me being silly. And I do post about the different little things that I do to my truck as well on there.
That sounds exciting. A new truck ready to be decorated and given that Jem Warren touch. Thank you so much for your time talking to us. It's been really fascinating getting an insight into you and all the stuff that you do.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Somerset Stories. If you liked it, you can subscribe on Apple, Spotify, Google, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to get in touch, you can find us on social media at Somerset Stories or email hello@somersetstories.com. Music on all Somerset Stories productions is created by Jazar. You can be found at betterwithmusic.com. See you next time.